Airbnb CEO Brian Chesky says post-pandemic, cities might actually want the company around. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace Tech. I'm Molly Wood. It has been a roller coaster year for a lot of businesses, few more nausea-inducing than Airbnb. The company saw an 80% drop in business last spring as the pandemic hit. It laid off a quarter of its employees, raised $2 billion in private funding, hurried the heck up, and introduced online experiences like virtual cooking classes to try to make any money at all. But by December, Airbnb had recovered enough for a blockbuster IPO and a profitable third quarter. Now, the company's facing the return of its core business, plus its pre-existing challenges like being blamed for housing shortages, and new ones like whether to house rioters planning to storm the U.S. Capitol. Brian Chesky is the CEO of Airbnb.
In the wake of the January 6th insurrection in Washington, D.C., a thought occurred to us, and the thought was, where are these people staying?
Right.
And the next thought occurred to us is, wait, people are going to come back to D.C. And we said, we're going to cancel all reservations for the week of the inauguration in D.C. That I think we learned the lesson a long time ago that we have to take more responsibility because our product is in the real world. And that's led to us having agreements with more than 1,000 cities around the world.
I want to ask you about that, actually, because that was sort of the other bubbling thing with Airbnb is this relationship with cities and whether Airbnb is partly to blame for the lack of affordable rentals. As you sort of prepare for that part of the business to come back in force, how have you rethought your relationships with cities and housing?
I think COVID allowed everyone to take a breather. I think we got a bit of a reset on the relationship with some cities. Cities started approaching us. Some of them actually said they wanted to partner us to get more demand because they said we have major budget shortfalls now. We have major tourism shortfalls.
So you think it's the kind of reset where cities were like, oh, we need you, as opposed to you, Airbnb, have to do more to deal with the question of housing supply?
Maybe not they need us, but they say, oh, maybe we can work together. Yeah. I feel very optimistic about our ability to have great relationships with cities. I mean, I think the other thing that's going to happen in travel, people aren't just going to travel the same 50 cities anymore. And that has had a way of redistributing travel to more communities. Because primarily, a lot of the conflicts are too many people in one place at the same time.
You've also said that you think this idea of digital nomads could be big, people booking longer-term stays. Do you think that could improve your relationships with cities and neighborhoods too, because people are not coming and going so quickly?
Yeah, I mean, I think the other trend is our business is becoming less transient. Monthly rentals is one of the fastest growing parts of our business, but I think the other shift is stays are going to be longer. And I think there's going to be this blurring of the line between traveling and living. It means that a lot of people are saying that they don't live any one place anymore. Or they, you know, it used to be you live one place and you go one or two nights for a business meeting and like 1 or 2 weeks for a vacation. Now, a world where you work from home means a world you can work from any home. And so I think you're seeing people where I think 3 day weekends will be every weekend for a lot of people. I think some people will take 5 day weekends. I think significantly more people will live in a different house over the summer than the house they currently live in. Where they used to just live in the same house, I think it would be very normal for people to go to a different house for the summer. I mean, it just makes, by the way, total sense why one would do that. And if you could say, well, how do they afford it? Well, they can rent their house and they're gone. So, you know, you can net it out. So these are things that are going to happen. But you're going to also have people that are just purely nomadic. Maybe not people with families, but retirees and empty nesters or, you know, young people, single people, people who like can move. I mean, I always had a dream of like, what if I could go to like, you know, a different city every month and live mm-hmm. there? This would be super interesting. Think about all the people you'd meet, all the connections you'd have. And by the way, in this new world, you can still stay connected to all the people you used to know. So I think this is where travel is going. Traveling, living are blurring together.
In June, you announced an initiative to specifically measure systemic bias on Airbnb through the collection of data. Can you give us a check-in on how that's working?
Yeah, so this is a project called Project Lighthouse. We did it in collaboration with Color of Change, one of the leading civil rights groups in the United States, along with some leading privacy groups. And we are intending to put out reports. We're going to put out a report later this year. In 2016, there was a major problem brought to our attention. I remember seeing on Twitter a hashtag trending. The hashtag was hashtag Airbnb While Black. And mm-hmm. it was basically people describing experiencing discrimination while trying to book rentals because you can see people's photographs on Airbnb. And this became an existential crisis to the company because the opposite of connection belonging is discrimination or worse. And so we mobilized the company. You know, we started to try to unpack this problem of how do we reduce bias? And we made a bunch of product improvements based on feedback. The problem is we weren't sure what was working or not. And so we said, you know, it's hard to change what you can't measure. And the problem is a lot of companies don't know how to measure discrimination because how do you measure discrimination without collecting information about people's races? And how do you do that online? And how do people consent to doing that? So we were able to come up with a solution that I felt like the leading privacy groups liked from a privacy standpoint and the leading civil rights groups seemed comfortable with. So that was really the needle, the thread. And we weren't the experts, so we weren't going to guess what was the right protocol here. And we are in the midst of taking a baseline measurement. So nothing to announce at this moment, but that's the process.
And then let's talk about experiences. You sort of really quickly spun up these online experiences in April, right after everybody kind of went home. Had you been planning that prior to the pandemic, or was it indeed the kind of, it was like the quick pop-up that you've portrayed it as?
No, we rolled it out and it was way more successful than I anticipated. I didn't really have any expectations because it only was built in, I think, 14 days. And one of the things I'm proud about the way we managed the crisis is we were never on defense. We weren't retrenching. You know, I said, like, in nature, those things that survive are those things that are adaptable. Mm-hmm. And so the most adaptable businesses win.
I mean, was it enough of a bump? Like, clearly it wasn't going to replace all of the lost business, but do you feel like it really rounded out your experiences offering, which you've said could end up being a bigger part of the business than home rentals even?
Yeah, absolutely. It's always hard to know how big stuff can become. And so I think like the biggest asset in someone's life is not their home. The biggest asset in your life is probably your time. And so we always viewed we weren't going to be like kind of service commodities like DoorDash. Like they do that really well. We're more on the experiential side, really something that's differentiated on the hosting standpoint. And the core idea was like when you get into Uber, you get a DoorDash, every one of those is basically the same experience. You don't want a different experience. You want the same experience every time. So therefore, individuality is not really, it's not the point of the service. Ours is really different. We're not a hotel. Our homes were all different. And we said, therefore, the other service we have, we really think our core is doing things that are one of a kind at scale. And so it turns out online experiences was able to do something in-person experiences couldn't do. Let me give you an example. If we have a great experience here in San Francisco, the problem is you have to come to San Francisco, experience it, right? So obviously people living here can do it, people visiting here can do it, but the vast majority of people, like San Francisco is a million people of a 7 billion population, most people don't live here. And so what online experiences was able to do was it was able to allow a host in San Francisco to get demand all over the world instantaneously. We had hosts making hundreds of thousands of dollars a year. I mean, it was very remarkable what ended up transpiring. And I think it's a sign of more innovation to come from Airbnb.
Yeah, you know, we've been talking a lot actually on the show about how a lot of small businesses basically were able to or had to try to access a national and even international market. It sounds like in a way you're talking about potentially evolving into a different kind of platform where people are not just homeowners with a business renting their homes, but small business people on your platform.
I think that we are not going to be limited to homes. And I don't think we ever thought we would only be limited to homes even before we launched experiences. I think that what is central to Airbnb is hosting. You know, the basic idea of Airbnb is more than just saving money. It's more than just traveling. The idea of Airbnb is really about connection.
I have a quick wrap-up question for you. This is crowdsourced and full disclosure, fully from my son, who wants to know, do you currently or have you ever had a steak in your pocket?
Oh, geez. Yes. I think he's referring to a story I told to my company where when I was in college, I think I was a freshman in college or something like that, I was like really hardcore into like weightlifting and ended up working at a movie theater, and I had to be on this diet where I'd eat steak, and I like they wouldn't give me a lot of breaks. So one time I actually put a steak in my pocket, and it was in a bag, but and I was eating it like a beef jerky. So I wasn't preparing to have embarrassing personal confessions.
I'm so sorry. Yeah,
on
totally.
NPR, but as long as that's the only one I have to do for a while, then
the 14-year-olds are deep sources. Let me tell you.
I know though. My God, that's like investigative journalism.
Yeah, totally. We don't mess around here. Brian Chesky is the CEO of Airbnb. And now for some related links. Obviously, it is not all sunshine and roses at Airbnb. While travelers might be returning and new hosts might be finding opportunity, the New York Times had a story last month about the hosts who are still smarting over the huge wave of cancellations when the pandemic first hit, and the fact that Airbnb insisted on 100% refunds, but didn't necessarily pay hosts back 100% of what they lost. More people are reportedly turning to other platforms and diversifying their rental options a little bit. Some are exploring direct booking, cutting Airbnb out completely. And the company has been on a bit of a charm offensive to woo hosts to the platform and keep them there. Meanwhile, competition is coming. A Barron story from last week notes that Booking.com is trying to increase its inventory of private homes to stay in and market that fact more aggressively to compete with Airbnb's name recognition. One other interesting thing Chesky told me was that Airbnb's business was able to rebound more quickly than other travel companies, in part because it's not that dependent on business travel, certainly not as much as airlines and hotels. And he thinks business travel is not coming back anytime soon, at least not the way it was, where we'd hop on a plane for any old reason, or zip to Europe and back for a conference over the span of a couple of days, or the whole company would come to one city for one meeting. In Bloomberg on Friday, the head of product and strategy for American Express's corporate travel group said all of that is almost certainly true, but suggested that instead of unnecessary quick trips, companies might prioritize a form of corporate get-together that is more fun and combines experiences with meetings like the good old days of offsites. Until then, still just Zoom, I guess. I'm Molly Wood, and that's Marketplace Tech. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.